They want me to get rid of my dog. Can they do that?
I'm being fined for leaving my garage door open too long.
What are covenants? Do I have any rights?
Help, I feel like I've left the American zone.
If you want the answers to those questions, join me, Sue Bartholomew, and my guests on The Commons every Saturday from 2 to 3 right here on WBR Fairfax Radio. We'll ask the experts and we'll untangle the truth about what's left of our property rights.
WBR-FM Fairfax.
A service of Fairfax Public Access and Cox Communications.
94.5 Cable FM.
Cox Cable Channel 37.
Comcast Cable Channel 24.27.
And broadcasted to the world in real audio at FCAC.org.
WBR-FM Fairfax.
On the Commons is a weekly radio show dedicated to discussing the many issues surrounding mandatory common ownership development. It is broadcast live from WBR Fairfax, Virginia. Join us as we explore the world of common ownership development, the fastest growing form of residential development in America today. This housing concept includes condominiums, cooperatives, and both attached and detached single-family homes that are part of a mandatory homeowners association. Unfortunately, this type of housing is not as utopian as its advocates would have us believe. Living in a mandatory homeowners association means giving up part of the American dream. It means giving up constitutional rights and control over one's most valuable asset, one's home. Living in a mandatory homeowners association means leaving the American zone. WEBR Fairfax Radio, you're on the Commons. I'm Sue Bartholomew, and joining us on the Commons today, we have Stephen Siegel. Stephen, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Sue, for having me on your show.
Steve is an attorney and he's a doctoral student at Columbia Law School, and he has written an absolutely amazing article. It's quite long, that was published in the Urban Lawyer, which is the American Bar Association's journal, right?
That's right. It's co-published by the American Bar Association and the University of Missouri School of Law.
And you want to tell us why you got, what attracted you? I mean, you're talking about the associations, the mandatory associations, the mandates across the country. What got your interest in this?
Well, I've written a prior article on this issue almost 10 years ago, and I've had quite a strong interest in the issue, and I should mention, by the way, that I am a member of a co-op in New York City and happen to be a co-op board president. So I'm from the other side as well. I'd like to think that I have multiple perspectives on this issue. Being on the board of a New York City cooperative is a challenging experience, and so I see it from the other side as well, and I'm not dogmatic in terms of this type of housing. I think there are, you know, there's something to be said for a board of directors having some ability to manage a property, and that may not be a popular thing for some of your listeners, but certainly I'm well aware of the perspective from the other side. And I should mention, Shu, that I've been involved with Professor Frank Askin at Rutgers in the prosecution of the Twin Rivers litigation. I've worked with him informally and formally on Twin Rivers for the past 5 years. And I've, at the Supreme Court level, which many of your listeners may know, this important bellwether case for constitutional rights in homeowners associations, which is pending before the New Jersey Supreme Court. I was honored to be the lawyer for AARP, who is an amicus in that case, and I'm representing AARP before the New Jersey Supreme Court. So I've very much been involved on the advocacy side for homeowners, and I've also been involved with the New Jersey homeowners advocates run by Margaret Barakiva, who's a great activist and who is attempting to get through the New Jersey legislature a comprehensive reform bill that will give more rights to homeowners. So I've seen this. I've been in the trenches. I've seen this from multiple perspectives. This article, though, is somewhat more theoretical and it really tries to ask the question, where did this phenomenon come from? How is it that in 1960 these associations virtually did not exist? I think the best figures we have is that there were 500 associations in 1960. And now, almost 50 years later, one in five Americans live in them. There are hundreds of thousands of them, and they're growing, as you all know,
mm-hmm.
at an explosive rate, particularly in the Southwest and the South, but also in places like Virginia and Maryland. I know where your show is broadcast.
Right.
And in where I am, in New Jersey, it's also a very large-scale phenomenon as well. And so, many people looking at this phenomenon will say, well, this is the genius of the marketplace. This is developers and the housing market responding to the demands of the home buying public and giving them what they want. And what's wrong with that? That's a good thing. We all know, for example, that senior citizens are looking for retirement communities. That's something that's as people get older and live longer, these communities have risen up to meet that demand. And other segments of the housing market, empty nesters, people who don't want to maintain their lawns and don't have the time because husband and wife work, and the concept that an association would provide these services is a good one, and they buy into that concept. But, and here's the big but, there's truth to all of that. But it's also true that in the course of my research as a doctoral student, and many people have arrived at this conclusion independently, that this is a conscious product of municipal decision-making
right.
to privatize a portion of services that traditionally were provided by municipalities. And moreover, because municipalities have control over what gets built and what doesn't get built, they have a very strong incentive to load shed their services. And in essence, what has happened in the last 30 or 40 years is that municipalities have discovered independently that they can require developers, as a condition of getting the approval to build a new development, that they must create a community association and they must assume responsibility for certain services. And that's what my paper is about. And although I don't claim this to be a new insight, other people have noted it in passing, my paper is solely about that, and it begins to look at how this came about, what evidence does there exist for this phenomenon. And I looked at actual laws and codes and ordinances, and it says it right in black and white. It will say, for example,
mm-hmm.
that and by the way, stop me if I'm going on a little bit too long.
No,
here.
You're doing fine, because there's a lot to cover, and I want to give you as much time as you need.
Okay, thanks. I'll keep going and just kind of give you a thumbnail sketch of what my paper is about and why it is that this insight that associations are not a market-driven phenomenon but are a conscious product of government policy is so important. Why it's so important because for courts, for example, to understand what associations do and the power that they exert over homeowners, the courts must take notice of the fact that these associations, again, in suburban areas from across the South and in places like Maryland, Virginia, are being created because municipalities have decided that they want to grow their tax base, but they don't want to assume full responsibility for services.
Right.
And voila! They came up with this brilliant insight, and I don't say that there's some sort of conspiracy here. The interesting point here is that it was kind of independently arrived at the local level across the country, and it's an interesting phenomenon that this phenomenon of load shedding, which has been going on ever since certainly, for example, Proposition 13 in California, where municipalities are under the gun. There are taxpayer revolts. They're saying, you know, this is, you know, the suburban sprawl and new taxes, we don't want it. We're voting you out. And so mayor and council will say, well, we've got developers threatening to sue us because we're not allowing them to build. We got taxpayers in revolt saying, you're going to be building new sewer systems. We don't want to pay for it. We got a great idea. Let's shunt this on to the developers. And let's say that you can't build unless you, developer, assume responsibility for these types of facilities. And the courts have upheld them. And you can do this. Just without getting too bogged down in the details, I want to point out a distinction here. There's a legal term called an exaction. And an exaction is precisely a requirement that a developer must do in order to get an approval from the municipality. And traditionally, exactions were the municipality saying to the developer, you have to construct a road through your development and turn it over to the municipality when you finish building it, and then we'll run the road. And this is an accepted part of land use law that a municipality absolutely can require a developer to build a road, a park, a sewage treatment plant, a variety of public works infrastructure as a condition of getting the approval to build. What's different now is that municipalities have said, not only must you build, but we don't want the public works, we don't want the infrastructure when you finish building it. We want you to retain it and turn it over instead to an entity that you create, a community association. And this insight that not only can you require a developer to build capital infrastructure, but require it to retain it rather than turning it over to the municipality, and to create a community association to run it. So, I mean, if you think about it, this is almost self-evident. I mean, given the fiscal dynamics of in fast-growing municipalities that are overwhelmed by demands for new building permits and can't possibly keep up with the infrastructure, everybody sort of arrived at this conclusion that they can do that, that it's legal, that they can require developers to not only build the infrastructure, but to run it through a community association. And in my research, I don't believe anyone has done this before, and it's a curious gap in the literature, I must tell you, that this phenomenon, which is all around us, and which is kind of like, I feel like, kind of the emperor's new clothes.
Yeah.
it's there. That is to say,
right,
the municipal codes and ordinances that, by the way, just as a lawyer, the law is for the most part accessible. You can go online. You can find statutes. You can find cases. It's more accessible than it's ever been. And so for non-lawyers, you know, who want to do their legal research, you can find it.
Yes.
But municipal codes were kind of a black hole until recently. How the heck could you find a code for Las Vegas, Nevada, or Clark County, which is one of the fastest growing counties in the country, unless you went to Clark County's municipal building and went through some old dusty law books? Well, of course, now that's online. And
right.
So what that means is that this policy that I'm referring to, which I think is not an exaggeration to say, is a large-scale privatization of municipal government that's going on all around the country, but which has been invisible. This policy is now, we can now access the law books for the codes and ordinances that actually implement it in a way that we couldn't 20 or 30 years ago. And because they were inaccessible in a way that, for example, state statutes, of course, were always accessible. You can just go to your local law library and pull out the statute books. My point is that this policy wasn't implemented by statutes that were enacted by state legislatures. They it was implemented at the kind of the grassroots level by mayor and councils saying, let's load shed, and here's an ordinance. It says you want to build what's called a planned unit development, we're going to require you to establish a community association. It's right there in black and white, and now with online accessibility to codes and ordinances, one of the things my paper does is to say, here's some text. If you don't believe me that this is an actual conscious product of local government policy, that this phenomenon of hundreds of thousands of new associations, then you can go and look at this because it's right there in these local municipal codes and ordinances, which, as I say, many of which are accessible online. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I think one thing I learned, I had someone from CAI on, Pia Trigiani was on the last time, and she said that the Virginia legislature is going to be considering or looking into enacting legislation that would require all streets through residential areas to be privately owned, which means you would have your first, I would think, your first state mandate.
That is right. I'm not aware of a statewide mandate, so that would be a kind of a breakthrough. A breakthrough has a positive connotation to it. I could consider it a negative breakthrough.
I agree, because I think this is going to then mushroom, because if Virginia does it, then Maryland will do it, and then New Jersey will do it, and California will do it. And before you know it, you will just totally wipe out all housing that is not in an association. So there would, in effect, be no choices whatsoever.
Right. And you're saying that this statute would actually apply to existing developments, not just new developments.
I don't know if they would or not. I doubt that they can do that, but, you know, we're tearing down the older developments, so, you know, they're not going to exist anyway.
Yeah. You're right. I don't think it could be applied retroactively, but if what you say is true, I do think that that's yet another kind of incarnation of this phenomenon, which maybe, I guess the silver lining in the cloud might be that maybe this will give the issue a visibility that it doesn't have. I really think that I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that this is a large-scale privatization of local government that's going on, and it's going on under the radar screen.
Mm-hmm.
There's an absolutely very little political consciousness to this issue. I mentioned in my paper that if the Bush administration put forth proposals to privatize Social Security, and it, of course, didn't pass, but there was enormous media scrutiny about this, and there was political debate that, is this a good thing? Should it be in the public sector? Should it be in the private sector? And people weighed in on that issue. This is an issue which I submit is a large-scale privatization of local government that has gotten no scrutiny. It's basically taking place in the back rooms of City Hall, in negotiations between developers and municipal officials. And by the way, I was talking about local codes and ordinances before that spell this out in black and white. That's true, but this phenomenon that I'm describing is also not just formal and codified, which is the term for saying put down into law, but also informal, in the sense that because of the nature of local government's power over the approval of developments, they don't even have to put it in the code. They can just say, look, you want to build this large planned unit development. We're not going to let you build it unless you assume responsibility for the streets and build a sewage treatment plant and run it and so on. And that's legal. They can do that, and it's done that way every day, because the zoning and subdivision codes allow really unbridled discretion on the part of municipalities to make those kinds of requirements, and it's the developer really almost has no choice but to knuckle under and say, okay, well, if I want to build particularly if I want to build these large subdivisions where you get preferential treatment under the zoning, I'm going to have to do this. So I guess sort of going back to my original point that I'm not against the creation of community associations per se, but what I'm against is situations that are increasingly apparent that even if a developer wanted to build a traditional single-family development,
they can't.
You can't do it in large parts of this country.
Right.
It's no longer an option that's a meaningful option that's on the table. And in my paper, by the way, I interview various developers, developers of large subdivisions in Arizona, in California, in New Jersey, and they say, we don't have any choice here.
Right.
I thought perhaps that the people who I was able to contact and identify might be reluctant to go on the record because these are sensitive issues.
They are, by the way. I haven't been able to get a single one on the air. They'll tell me privately off the air, but they will not go on the air. Yeah, they will not go on the air and talk about it.
Yeah, it is a sensitive issue, and I attempted to contact informally through a questionnaire, and of course, like any mailed questionnaire, I got a very low response rate. But I will say this. Of those that did respond, and I don't have the statistic right in front of me, every single developer who responded said, yes, this municipalities require me to do this, to provide these services, and it would be impossible for me in the communities in which I build to build in the traditional way. And so there it is. I mean, I don't say that I've done a survey and used a rigorous survey methodology, but I consider that my paper has sort of tried to sort of be the first cut in this sort of neglected field to say there's substantial evidence out there that that municipalities have decided to do this, and here's the evidence. And I'll leave it for others to begin to say, go into Arizona or Nevada or Virginia, and let's do let's do a survey funded with $500,000 and banks of telephones, and we'll try and nail down as close as we can exactly the percentages and try and follow up with developers and get them to commit to the record, but. I think even the most conservative commentator on the scene today would say, I see what you're saying. This is at least a partial or substantial product of a government policy. But so what? So what? This is good. It's less government, and let's have these efficient private service providers take over from bloated municipal government and the bureaucrats. And let's have homeowners take control of their own destiny, and we're all for it.
But that's not working that way, is it, Steve?
But it's not working that way, and that's why I'm sort of segueing to a different part of my paper. That once we establish that evidence, at least sort of make a first cut to show what I believe is already the obvious. As I said, the sort of emperor's new clothes. That. The large-scale growth of community associations is to a great extent the conscious product of government policy, then the question becomes, as the academics say, a normative question. Is this good or bad? And my answer to that is it's bad. But having said that, I'm not saying that community associations should not be created or should be banned in future development. I'm saying that if a developer wants to build a community association and he perceives a market for it, then he should build it. But if a developer wants to build a traditional single-family home development that with full municipal services, he should be able to do that too. And why is that? Because this regime of requirement of building homeowners associations, his requirement of land use approval, is bad for a number of reasons. First of all, even though a conservative might say this is good because we're kind of contracting out more governmental functions to the marketplace, if you look at it in a different way, what you're doing is saying that the traditional way of American home building that existed for most of the history of our country is no longer on the table. Government is saying, you no longer have the option to do it that way. We don't want you to do it that way. Now, that seems to me to be a heavy-handed government intervention. On the, you know, in other words, contrary to what a conservative critic would say, I think that people should have the choice. And that's what I always understood traditional conservatism to be about, is having the choice to buy in to this regime of servitudes and a very complicated set of restrictive covenants. If people want that, then so be it. As long as they're fully informed and they understand it before they buy it and their eyes are open to it, then let them buy it. But, you know, as we all know, that's often not happening, and people should have the choice, particularly since the single-family home on a lot has been, you know, the American dream and has been the dominant way that people, at least middle-class people, once they, you know, are able to get enough money together and move to the suburban green pastures and raise a family, that the home is the castle. That's been the way, at least for the for a good part of the 20th century, that people lived and people wanted to live.
That's right. It was the urban flight. They wanted the elbow room. They wanted the healthier environment to raise their families in, and that's going away very quickly.
It is. I mean, again, some people may choose to want to live in a gated community. Some people may want to choose to volunteer to run on a board, and they will get to know their neighbors better. I can't categorically dismiss that, but what I'm talking about is choice, and I'm saying that some people want to live in a traditional suburban community without restrictive covenants, without associations telling them how they should park their car and what sign they should display. That's what they want, but they can't get it today.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I say to a conservative who talks about, this is actually the implementation of a conservative ideal, I say, no, it's not.
No,
conservatism
it's not.
Is about free choice.
Right. And it's minimal government. What we've done here is added another layer of government as well, and we've got the issue of double taxation
that
we can't get away from. So this goes absolutely against everything that the conservatives say they want.
I absolutely agree, and that is a critical point, Shu, because the if we're talking about building affordable housing, and then if you think about what's happening in places that require community associations, is that and I'll just back up for a second in terms of understanding zoning law. I mean, zoning is telling a developer that he can only put a certain number of houses on a certain number of lots, and his profit, therefore, will be limited by whatever the zoning tells him. Now, I used the term before, planned unit development, which is has the unfortunate acronym of PUD.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And planned unit developments are really something that came about 40 years ago and has really become the major vehicle by which community associations are built and established. And in a planned unit development context, the developer goes in and negotiates with the municipality, and at the end of the day, the municipality will say, you can be relieved of the zoning obligations, for example, to build one house on one lot, and you can build what's called cluster housing.
Right.
Cluster housing means that the land price per housing unit is lower, and that means the house price can be lower.
Right.
That's a very good thing. But in the context of that PUD, land use approval, they'll say, but, you know, you need a community association, you're going to have to privatize the streets, and you're going to have to build a sewage treatment plant that the association will run. So here's my point, is that the PUD type of zoning is potentially the way to build the most affordable housing in the suburbs. But the quid pro quo is the most affordable housing is then required to assume the highest tax burden
right.
in the community. Why? Because if you consider the tax to be both the basic real estate tax paid to the municipality plus the fees to the homeowner association to run the private infrastructure that in other contexts would be run by the municipality, then the net effect is that this regime is a way of putting a tax onto the most affordable housing. That's not good. In other words, you know, if we need to make, we need to provide a regulatory program that will build the most affordable housing in new developing areas for the most number of people. But municipalities have said, we'll let you build cluster housing, but you're going to have to assume responsibility for all these services, which will be borne on the back of the homeowners. So I guess what I'm saying is that the municipality is giving with one hand and taking away mm-hmm. with the other. It's giving a zoning bonus to the developer to make the housing more affordable, but at the same time, it's saying we're going to, in effect, impose a higher tax on the homeowners for the and so I'm assuming that there will be the net effect of the zoning bonus and the higher tax will be a somewhat more affordable housing than you might otherwise be able to build, but you're, in effect, taxing the most affordable housing at the highest level.
You're right. We're going to take a short break. We're talking to Stephen Siegel. We'll be right back with lots more, and this is a great article, so don't go away. We'll WBR Fairfax Radio, you're on the Commons. I'm Sue Bartholomew, and on the Commons with us, we have Steve Siegel. Steve, thanks again for joining us. I know we
sort of
got disconnected during the break. I don't know what happened. I think it's those calling cards that we use sometimes. But we were talking about what you term public service exactments and the fact that we've privatized, we are in the process of privatizing government. You don't think that it's such a great idea. You think that the Americans want and need more choices in housing.
I do, Shu. I think it's the privatization, as I was saying before, is something that needs to be debated by the public and understood. And unfortunately, this is a policy that municipalities have implemented in back rooms where negotiations are made between developers and the municipalities to be able to build what the developers want to build. And the developers have little choice but to say, okay, you're telling me I want to build 150 housing units here, but you're telling me that I've got to build the roads and I've got to build the sewage treatment facilities. And then you're telling me that not only do I have to build them, and that's what's called an exaction, but I can't turn them over to the municipality when I finish constructing them, which was the old way of doing it. I have to retain them and then turn them over to an association, and the association has to run them. And the developer says, okay, well, if that's what I need to get a building permit, I'll do it. But the that process, that decision, was made between the developer and the municipality, the elected officials, or the planning board officials. It was not made in the clear light of day, and it certainly wasn't made with the homeowners who will be living there. Of course, they don't exist at the moment. They will be moving there. But in other words, the whole process is flawed because a decision as important as that, the shape of a new community, how it's going to be run, questions of governance, are being made by people who have their own agendas and who the developer will, of course, in a few years leave the scene and go on to the next development.
Right.
And he'll have nothing to do with the management and operation of that community. But he will, in effect, have kind of formed a constitution, if you will, a private constitution, but, you know, unlike, say, the framers of the U.S. Constitution, who they were citizens, and the Constitution was ratified, and the next generation accepted those strictures. But I guess from a theoretical standpoint, you can't say the developer is a framer of a constitution, because the developer has a fundamentally different interest than the future homeowners. There isn't a sense
but
that...
But it's not the developer. I mean, it's going under the developer's name, but it's not the developer that's writing these constitutions. It's the industry. It's the members of the attorneys who ultimately will benefit.
Well, that's right, too. I guess I'm not only talking about the issue of the CCs and Rs, the covenants, conditions, and restrictions, as they're commonly known, and how they're drafted, but I am talking about the fundamental question of what services the associations will be required to provide.
Right.
And as to that issue, that's not a decision by a lawyer. That's a decision,
right,
again, forged in a room,
right,
where the developer and the municipality are bargaining as to whether this thing can be built at all.
Right.
And what I'm saying as to that is that that policy sort of multiplied by 10,000, because it's happening all over and everywhere, is a policy that the net effect is changing, you know, the American way of life. I don't think that sounds maybe a bit hyperbolic, but I don't think that's an exaggeration. And the problem is that that's a policy that nobody in the sort of the public realm is sitting down and saying, is that a good thing? Or are people saying, should we have another tier of quasi-government, or should we have sort of almost kind of a guarantee that if, again, I want to back up for a second and say, I'm not condemning community associations per se. I'm saying there should be a choice, and I'm saying that if a developer wants to build one, he should be allowed to build one.
If the market
wants it, but... The people who say that this is in response to the market and people are voting with their feet,
right,
by moving there, that is an incorrect statement. People in many areas of the country no longer have that choice.
Right.
And so there isn't a voting with their feet. What there is in many, many cases, and I'm making generalizations here, of course, but one has to talk about a broad public policy question like this. But what I'm saying is that the process is flawed, that this, the net effect of all these microscopic decisions being made in developers and municipalities across the country is to preclude traditional housing and to preclude choice and to have no public debate over it. And that's wrong. And I do hope that... a show like this and in other venues, that this issue can begin to well up into public consciousness and say, let's step back. What are we doing here?
I was going to ask you, is it too late for the public debate? But you're saying, no, it's not.
No, I mean, 1 in 5 Americans live in community associations. And, I've no doubt that in 10 years will be 1 in 4 or maybe 1 in 3 at the rate things are going. And but certainly, there are very few community associations in North Dakota or Maine, but in Virginia and Florida and California, they have become the dominant method of housing. In those states, it's apparent that the door is closing, so to speak, on traditional forms of housing. And if what you tell me about the Virginia legislature taking the next step in at the state level as opposed to the municipal level, effectively saying, this load shedding is great. I mean, it's a politician's dream when you think about it, because a politician at the local level, if you're a mayor, you want to increase your tax base because more tax base means more money.
Right.
But you don't want to increase your services. So the mayor's dream is increase taxes, not by increasing taxes on existing homeowners, but increase taxes by increasing the size of the base, but not have to provide the concomitant services. And it's no accident that this sort of quote-unquote solution was arrived at independently at the local level across the country as if by magic. Again, one could almost say maybe there was a conspiracy. No conspiracy, but it from the limited fiscal perspective of the municipality, this is a win-win situation. They get their increased tax bases, and they minimize their service outlays. But the process is flawed because the municipality is concerned only with pleasing the existing residents. The new residents who will have this double taxation, well, they can't vote at the moment that the decision is being made. And so this sort of two-tiered system is being put in place at a time that, politicians, love these little loopholes, where they can be the heroes for increasing the tax base and thereby keeping tax rates low for the existing residents, but shunt on to the new residents, the newcomers, what I consider to be an unfair part of municipal costs. Now, I think by saying it in those terms, probably that's not a very controversial position from the point of view of the community association industry. Even CAI would agree that double taxation is an issue. That's probably one thing that unifies everybody in this segment of society.
In the article, Steve, you talked about you questioned the constitutionality of what was happening, and I think you sort of questioned it on the basis of equal taxation. We're kind of running a little short on time here, and if you could just touch on that and maybe why there hasn't been a little more judicial oversight on this particular issue.
Oh, well, I did... I'm sure there are people listening who are interested in constitutional issues here, based on state action doctrine, which is an entirely different subject. But Shu, I think the issue that you raise, which is a kind of a narrow point, is that most state constitutions have a requirement that when local governments impose property taxes, that they apply the tax rate and the tax assessment in an equal and fair way. My earlier point is that homeowners' fees are the functional equivalent of real estate taxes, so that if a court were to view those fees as de facto real estate taxes, then, of course, one could say that there was unequal taxation because similar properties were being assessed differently. That requires a conceptual leap to say that fees should be deemed to be taxes, and I'm not aware that any court has so held. There are a number of the courts are still grappling. What Twin Rivers case in New Jersey shows is that community associations are still in a situation where courts don't quite know what to make of them. They're still attempting to come up with new paradigms and new legal doctrines to come to terms with this phenomenon. And I guess that's just another example. I mean, if fees could be deemed to be the functional equivalent of real estate taxes, then you might run afoul of state constitutional mandates that require equal taxation. But I think we're a long way off from that.
Okay, so there's nothing that we can do about that right now, huh?
No, I think that's probably not one of the more promising judicial venues. I think that there are a number of things that are happening across the country, since you mentioned constitutional issues, Shu, I did an earlier paper. In an academic journal, separate from this paper that just came out in the Urban Lawyer, on the application of constitutional values and constitutional rights to associations. That's something that a number of commentators have looked at, and that's what the Twin Rivers case is all about, is saying that if it looks and walks and quacks like a duck, then it's a duck. And so
that decision should be coming out soon, right?
Yes, it is. It's it was argued, I think, in February, and right. I would imagine that the New Jersey Supreme Court will be handing down a decision by the end of its term in June, and that is a bellwether case. It is based on the New Jersey Constitution, not the federal Constitution,
right.
Which and the New Jersey Supreme Court is one of the most activist courts in the nation. I'm proud to say New Jersey gets denigrated in many ways in the national consciousness, but we're very proud of our court system here, and the New Jersey Supreme Court is a very influential state Supreme Court, and we are crossing our fingers as to how they come down on this, but it's an important substantive as well as symbolic decision, potentially, in saying that at least in certain circumstances, you don't check the First Amendment, at the guardhouse at the entrance to your gated community. That there are things that should hold. And in my earlier law review article about this issue, there's an old chestnut of a case, a U.S. Supreme Court case called Marsh versus Alabama, that
right.
involved company towns, which the court back in 1946 said, the people who live in these towns have every bit have the same amount of rights as people who don't live in them, and we don't see any problem in essentially saying that that the fact that the town is owned by a private company shouldn't make any difference if you're living in a town. Now, that's a breathtaking decision, and yet, at the federal level, that doctrine, which is called state action theory, has really not been successful in being applied to community associations. The federal courts have grown more conservative, and state action doctrine is sort of moribund, and it's unlikely that at the federal level, an aggressive application of state action theory to associations is going to happen. But at the state level, and this is what Twin Rivers is all about, individual state Supreme Courts may look to their own constitutions and find some rights that are more extensive than their federal counterpart rights, like in the First Amendment. New Jersey has a counterpart free expression provision that goes further than the First Amendment. But in any event,
Frank Askin was on the show, and I asked him, I said, Frank, why didn't you just do this?